If you have hyperthyroidism or Hashimoto's and are looking to save your thyroid, then you might want to take the 60-second Save My Thyroid quiz to find out how likely it is that you can save your thyroid. Upon completing the quiz, you will receive your thyroid saving score and a free report explaining your unique results, along with some things you can do to regain your health. To take the quiz, visit savemythyroid.com/quiz. Thank you for joining me on the Save My Thyroid podcast, where I help people save their thyroid and regain their health. My name is Dr. Eric Osansky, and if you have hyperthyroidism, including Graves' disease or toxic multinodular goiter, then you will especially benefit from these episodes. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you also need to save your thyroid, and therefore you will also find many of the episodes to be valuable, including this one, where I interviewed Dr. Jolene Brighton, as we'll talk about libido, PMS and periods, orgasms, and everything else you wanted to know but were afraid to ask. And if you enjoy this interview, which I'm sure you will, then I would highly recommend reading or listening to Dr. Jolene's excellent book, Is This Normal? As usual, make sure you listen to the post-episode chat after the outro music, as I'll expand on Everyone's Normal is Different, Endometriosis, the importance of T2, low libido versus heightened libido, orgasms versus corgasms, and the vaginal microbiome. And you can access the show notes by visiting savemythyroid.com/138. Anyway, here's my interview with Dr. Jolene.
Welcome to the Save My Thyroid podcast, hosted by Dr. Eric Osansky. To stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics, visit savemythyroid.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your doctor. Now let's head to the show.
So I am super excited to chat with today's guest. We have Dr. Jolene Brighton, and we're going to be talking about sex, hormones, periods, of course, tying some of it into thyroid health. And so let me go ahead and dive into Dr. Jolene's impressive bio here. So Dr. Jolene Brighton is a hormone expert, nutrition scientist, and thought leader in women's medicine. She is board certified in naturopathic endocrinology and trained in clinical sexology. Dr. Brighton is the author of Is This Normal? A Non-Judgmental Guide to Creating Hormone Balance, Eliminating Unwanted Symptoms, and Building the Sexual Desire You Crave. A fierce patient advocate and completely dedicated to uncovering the root cause of hormonal imbalances, Dr. Brighton empowers women worldwide to take control of their health and their hormones through her website and social media channels. Dr. Brighton is an international speaker, clinical educator, and medical advisor within the tech community. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Jolene.
Absolutely. I'm so glad to be here with you and everyone who's listening right now.
Yeah. And, you know, we were chatting a little bit before, you know, I started recording this and I was telling you how I was listening to your audiobook of, you know, Is This Normal? And really, really enjoyed it. I also let you know how my wife was, you know, just, you know, kind of not freaked out, but she was just surprised because, again, you don't hold back in the book. I mean, you talk, you know, about sex, you talk about orgasms. And again, we'll talk about some of that here, but a very necessary book. So what motivated you to write the book, Is This Normal? Because you have another book prior to that, you know, The Pill Book, which also was an amazing book. So if you could dive a little bit into that background.
Is This Normal was born out of all of the questions that I received. So many people not understanding their body, having received misinformation. We know social media is full of it when it comes to women's body. And really, you know, my patients, my social media followers, everybody asking time and again, is this normal? But, you know, there was that inspiration. That's actually how we arrived at the title. And when I look back at like, where did this really come from and what was it rooted in? Well, firstly, women know their bodies. They know they're normal. However, they haven't been given all of the tools, all of the information. And in fact, they've been given a lot of misinformation. So sex education, we know when you look at the states in the United States, most of them are not teaching medically accurate sex ed. And at the same time, we're being told a lot of things like period pain is normal. Being tired is normal. I'm sure that you have a lot of people who have heard that, especially when it comes to thyroid disease, or the myriad of things that affect women. They're just chalked up as being normal. Yet when women say, I know my body, this isn't normal, they're often pushed back on. So I wanted to help answer the question of what's normal, what's not when it comes to our anatomy, when it comes to our hormones, when it comes to our sex life, and then also help people navigate finding their normal. Because as anybody knows who has taken a statistics class, normal exists within a bell-shaped curve. And right smack dab in the middle, that's where just like a lot of people are hanging out. And then you've got the outliers underneath. So you've got the distribution, right? The normal distribution. So normal is a gradient. And even when you get outside of that bell curve, you will find that people are still normal. It just might be their normal. So I help people navigate all of that and really set it up as the book that if you were handed this from the day you got your period, you are less likely to experience medical gaslighting. You are less likely to struggle with your hormones. And you are certainly more likely to experience the pleasure that you're after in this life.
Okay. So everybody's normal is different. And then you also mentioned the book that people mistake common for normal, that that's just because something is common doesn't mean it's normal. And people ask me all the time as well. They ask me, maybe not relation to, you know, sex and orgasms. And I mean, sometimes it are hormones, but for so many different things, is this normal? Is this normal? And I have to also say the same thing. It's common, but it doesn't mean it's normal. But you kind of just expanded on that. You know, maybe it is like someone's normal, but not necessarily normal for everyone.
As you bring that up, I think right away about how period pain is chalked up to be normal. It's not normal. Period pain is not normal. It is common. I have been saying this for well over a decade. If you scroll my Instagram, you will see that, like, I mean, I was popping off about that like so long ago. And people really have challenged me. Doctors have challenged me and said, well, if it's not normal, then why do so many women have period pain? And I'm like, yeah, doctor, why don't you look it up? Like, what is going on here that is such a disservice to your patients? I think the other thing, we do a big disservice in medicine when we mistake that what we see are sick people, right? Who comes to us? People who have problems, people who want problems fixed. And we mistake our experience of constantly seeing that like everybody has period pain as being something that must be normal because everybody has it. You have a bias in that. And in fact, you know, we know from the research that because of this bias, because of the bias that exists in medicine that is against women and puts them at a disadvantage, something like period pain or pain with sex that just really gets dismissed or chalked up as normal is a big reason why it's estimated that, you know, for the condition of endometriosis, 6 out of 10 never get the diagnosis. And in fact, it can go as far as 11 years for somebody to actually get the diagnosis. This is a condition that affects anywhere from 10 to 15% of women. And so I bring this up because I think it's important to understand that sometimes people are like, oh, well, like, what's the big deal? Why should we even care about this? This happens way too much in women's medicine. And it's because, like, in a case of endometriosis, this one example, a leading cause of infertility, something that can lead to gastrointestinal issues, problems that evolve with the bladder. So having actual lesions. So endometriosis is when tissues that are similar to the lining of your uterus, but not exact, exist outside of your uterus and they respond to estrogen. It is deemed a estrogen dominant condition because estrogen will stimulate the tissues to grow. And just like the lining of your uterus, they will bleed when you menstruate. And because of that, you can end up with strictures, so tightening of tissues, lesions that are very, very painful and lots of inflammation. And that can affect your ability just to have a bowel movement every day.
And you said on average with endometriosis, it could take, how long did you say? Did you say like it could take up to like 10 years or longer to get diagnosed?
Yes, it can take up to 11 years. And when you consider the research says that only 6 out of 10 are actually getting the diagnosis, then you consider that those 6 may have had to go 11 years of going to their doctor saying, I have period pain, I have pain with sex, I have pain with urination, I have pain with my bowel movements, I have extreme bloating that is occurring around my period. This is something that you'll see a lot on the internet. I don't know if you've seen this meme going around, but women are like, oh, all the hot girls have bloating. Hot girls have bloating. And I look at that as a practitioner. I'm like, wait, if you have bloating and it's that significant, some of these women are showing pictures of 4 to 6 months, you know, pregnant looking bellies. Like that's how bloated they're becoming. When you consider that, I'm like, hold up. This could be endometriosis, especially considering how long it takes to get the diagnosis, how misunderstood it is, and how many doctors are really dismissive of these things. As you know, working in your patient population, if we see extreme bloating like that, that could also be small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It could be something causing inflammation in the intestines. It could be related to thyroid disease and slow motility. So in anybody who says like hot girl, all the hot girls bloat, I'm like, pause, back it up, because that's not normal.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you mentioned that. So you're not saying that endometriosis is the cause of all bloating, and same thing with period pain. If a woman has period pain, it doesn't necessarily mean they have endometriosis, just that it's commonly overlooked and commonly missed. And like you said, many doctors might say that period pain is normal. And maybe it is, or maybe it's not related to endometriosis. But again, the point is that they just dismiss it and they do tell the patient that it is normal. And maybe the same goes with bloating and some of these other symptoms. So, I mean, sticking with the topic of PMS and period pain, and then also like periods, like, you know, some women have like heavy menstrual flow. So again, I guess this is where we get into common versus normal. So, because a lot of women do have some pain and cramping, and some have a heavier flow. So in a perfect world, would you say then there would be no period pain and like a regular flow? Or again, is some woman's normal to have like a heavier flow and maybe some cramping, for example?
So the question is like, what is the flow and what are we talking about here? So let's break down what a normal period should look like. So firstly, having some mild cramping, totally normal. Feeling a bit tired before your period, also normal. Feeling like you're totally wiped out, exhausted, never should be considered normal. If you are driven to have to take NSAIDs consistently every single period for multiple days on your period, that's not normal. Sometimes people will push back and say, well, everybody's pain tolerance is different. It doesn't matter. Your pain tolerance, like whether it's different than anyone else, doesn't matter if your period interferes with your activity of daily living. It causes you to vomit, to cry. You're having extreme diarrhea with it. These are signs that your prostaglandins can be really elevated. Prostaglandins are hormone-like chemicals, which stimulate the uterus contract. Very good thing until there's too many of them or they're super potent. So they also can be part of the inflammatory picture that we see with what people classify as the period flu. Period flu is feeling really achy, like you're getting sick, very fatigued before your period. That's not normal either. And I got more to say about the period, but just to jump in real quick, omega-3 fatty acids in the diet and increasing magnesium are two things that you can do to mitigate those prostaglandins and make an easier period. So I typically recommend that you start with diet first, but as you know, eating cold water fish consistently throughout the week, getting enough magnesium-rich foods, that can be a struggle for some people. So looking at something like 1,500 to 2,000 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acids, you actually make prostaglandins from omega-3 fatty acids. That's why those are so important. And then anywhere from 150 to maybe 300 milligrams of magnesium. I like glycinate best because that helps women sleep as well. That can be really helpful to bring in and to help mitigate some of that pain. So I just wanted to give those solutions before I go further with the period talk. So with a period, the average cycle is going to fall 3 to 5 days. If it's less than 2 days, that's pointing to too little estrogen. And we can see that in late stage perimenopause. Late stage perimenopause, that is right before you move into menopause, totally normal for periods to kind of go all over the place, but also to have those shorter periods. If you are younger than 45, I always ask the question of like, you know, before we just say, oh, it could be perimenopause, I always am like, well, could it be anything else going on? And is there anything we can do to help with that? If your period's going beyond 7 days, that can be problematic. It is problematic. We get worried about that. That's too heavy of a period. Maybe estrogen is stimulating the endometrium too much. Maybe you have fibroids. Maybe you have adenomyosis, which is, as I explained in the book, a cousin of endometriosis. And you can see clots accompanying the menstrual cycle when you have adenomyosis. And I will say that condition is missed even more than endometriosis. And I talk about a lot of conditions that are missed in the book, in order to help women advocate for themselves and have a more productive conversation with their doctor. Now, in terms of the flow, like how heavy should it be? Here's what's normal and not always talked about. So firstly, a period that starts and then kind of stops, that's normal. So maybe your period that you have it, you're like, oh, I'm starting to have a flow several days. And then it's like, well, it's really tapered off. And then it makes an appearance the next day. That's not necessarily abnormal. Having a period flow that's so heavy that you need a super tampon and a pad, or you're changing a tampon or a pad every single hour. So I'm not talking about a tampon and a light day. I'm talking about a tampon and a pad because the flow is so heavy. It's the only way to contain it. If you're changing one of those products every hour, if you have to wake up in the middle of the night because the flow is so heavy, you have to change those products. This is too heavy. And I have billions of checklists, it feels like, in the book, but I have a little checklist on like what's not normal for your period, what is normal. But it's important to understand what these parameters are, because like I said, you know, your period might be 3 days up to 6 days, and that's all considered normal. But when we have these outliers, we need to investigate what's going on. So we've talked about period pain. We've talked about the period itself. I'd like to talk about cycle length. You good with that?
Yes, definitely.
Cool. So, because this is another one people are really confused about, where they're like, well, my period has always come 24 days and isn't a 28-day cycle the norm? Very few people are having a predictable 28-day cycle regularly. We set it up as a way to teach about the menstrual cycle. And, you know, there is some science to support, like there's these averages of how long the luteal phase can last and how long it should last and when ovulation might happen. But the myth of the 28-day cycle has also lended itself to the myth of everybody ovulates on day 14. And none of that is true. You might even ovulate 1 month on day 13 and the next month on day 15. But it shouldn't be that you ovulate 1 month on day 10 and the next month on day 28. And your cycle shouldn't be something that is less than 21 days or greater than 35 days. Even though I say that, if you consistently have had a 38-day cycle your entire life and you've been worked up and nothing's going on, then that is your normal. But when in medicine, if you're going beyond 35 days, we need to investigate things like polycystic ovarian syndrome or PCOS. There's all other conditions as well, but PCOS is far more common than those. And if your cycle length suddenly changes, we need to look at it. Could this possibly be hypothyroidism? Changes in the menstrual cycle are one of the most missed symptoms when it comes to hypothyroidism in my experience. And that's because clinicians are trained to put someone on the pill when the cycles become irregular rather than test and understand what's going on. Unless, the caveat being, you want to have a baby, then you might get that thyroid panel. So when it comes to the cycle length, that should be pretty predictable within a few days of itself. So it's not abnormal if you did have 27 days and 29 day cycles, but it is abnormal if there is a change in what's been your normal, or you are less than 21 or greater than 35. And if you never know when your cycle's showing up, you definitely need to see a provider.
I should say, I see a lot of people with hyperthyroidism as well, which could also impact the cycle and in different ways too. I can't say there's a consistent pattern. I mean, some people will completely stop cycling for a few months. Sometimes it might be more frequent as far as when they're dealing with hyperthyroidism, including Graves' disease. But yeah, so regardless whether someone has hypo or hyperthyroidism could impact. And like you said, a lot, especially in the case of hypothyroidism, a lot of times it's missed and, you know, then doctors will look at other things. So thank you for sharing that.
Totally. And I just want to say that I see the same thing with any thyroid disease, is that sometimes the cycle stops, sometimes it becomes irregular, sometimes the periods become very long. So that is something that should always be ruled out. And Most people are not aware of this, and you may be, but I definitely want your audience to understand that when it comes to follicular development, this is how we get a mature egg that we then ovulate, that is very, very dependent on the thyroid hormones being optimized. If you want to have a baby, absolutely crucial. If you don't want to have a baby, absolutely crucial, because only by ovulation do we get the progesterone levels that we need. But what is interesting is that, I mean, you've been in the thyroid space for a long time. Most doctors are going to just check a free T4. Then you get to functional medicine. We're looking at a free T3. And we've got those patients who just do better on natural desiccated thyroid hormone, which we know also contains T2. And I have always said the body doesn't do something for nothing. Like, if it's still making these hormones, there's a reason. And what's interesting is when you look at the research, T2 is actually involved in that follicular development and interaction with the mitochondria, which are really tending to the health, the quality of the eggs, and the health of the ovary overall. So thyroid health directly impacts ovarian health. And this is so crucial, not just for pregnancy, but in the longevity conversation, because the longer we can have our own natural hormones taking care of us, the less risk we are for things like dementia, cardiovascular disease, osteoporosis, type 2 diabetes. I could keep going. Take care of your thyroid, your mitochondria, and that is one key to taking care of your ovaries.
So based on what you just said, if someone is taking, you know, levothyroxine, synthetic T4, and if they are having fertility issues, again, not to say it's definitely related to that, but it could be, just because when they're taking T4, they're obviously missing out on the T2, I mean, and they're hoping that it'll convert into T3.
Yeah, the hope, right? Of like, will it convert? So unless you're post-thyroidectomy, your thyroid's been removed, your thyroid is still going to make some T2. It's going to putt along. It's going to do that. And what we do understand really well from the research is that T4 is absolutely crucial, not just in follicular development, in that egg health, but also preventing miscarriage, for baby getting that. The long-term studies that have looked at when mom had insufficient T4 showed that even these children, they followed this cohort up to 16 years of age, and they were behind in terms of cognition and motor skills. So we know it has a tremendous impact on fetal growth and development. And so for anyone listening, if you're like, why is my doctor giving me T4? Because T4 crosses the placenta. And there's this magic thing that happens in medicine where as soon as you become pregnant, you just become the thing that's carrying the baby in the way of the baby, and everybody's focused on the baby. And they forget that, like, yeah, your health and well-being matter as well. I say that kind of backhandedly. We know there's great providers out there, but we also know that the United States, you know, we're at the bottom. We rank bottom when it comes to maternal fetal outcomes, when it comes to obstetric violence. We win at that. We're not doing well as a developed nation. And so I just want people to understand that if you have a great provider, yay, celebrate it. Maybe share it in the comments. That would be really great if you share it in the comments with other people. And if you don't have a great provider and you feel like it's just you, it is not just you. But back to your point, I just want to say something that's been very interesting that I have observed and used in my clinical experience is that women who aren't necessarily presenting with hypothyroidism, but they're going through IVF, sometimes giving as like a very low dose, like 25 micrograms of levothyroxine, can actually improve the outcomes of IVF. Do I have great studies that I can tell you about that? No, but when we see things like, hey, that free T4, it's like hanging around one. Sometimes it drops below one. You know, ideally we want that 1.2, 1.4. That's somewhere where it's like, let's just try. We're only going to do it for one cycle. That's only going to be a few weeks to like support you. You're not going to have hyperthyroid symptoms from that. And I've actually seen some pretty good outcomes. So take that clinical pearl, people, for what it's worth, and discuss it with your provider.
No, that was awesome information. Thanks for sharing that. Hey, this is Dr. Eric. And if you're looking to do everything you can to save your thyroid gland, in addition to listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways we can help you. First of all, I've written a book on hyperthyroidism called Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease, as well as a book called Hashimoto's Triggers, which of course is on Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And you can find both of these on Amazon, as well as other websites where books are sold. Second, you could also join my Graves' Disease and Hashimoto's healing community by visiting autoimmunethyroidgroup.com. And finally, if you want to get personal help from me, you could visit the website workwithdrerik.com. Just to let you know, I only see a limited number of new patients each month, and I do require anyone interested to complete a brief online application before working with me. And now back to the show. Low sex drive, low libido, something else that maybe practitioners in general, maybe not functional medicine practitioners, but medical practitioners would say is normal, but more common. So, you know, why is that so common? What are some of the underlying causes?
Okay, so hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. Oh man, the way your nerves are so grated in hyperthyroidism, like good luck getting in the mood, right? That can just be really hard. So to answer your question, why is it that so many women go to their provider and say, I'm struggling with low libido, and their provider's like, well, you were born with ovaries, that's just normal. Well, really, and I break this down in, is this normal? If we go back and we look at the history of medicine has essentially said, we have this male component, that is the standard, that is perfection. We will measure everything against this. And this like in, you know, other inferior model over here with baby making accessories, like that one should match, right? And so everything is through the lens of men. And with that lens, the myth, and I say this is a myth because I think it's unfair pressure that society puts on men, that men are always in the mood. Men always want sex. And men have more testosterone that they're using at a cellular level. Therefore, testosterone is the key hormone driving it. And that's men are always in the mood. And what we understand, okay, firstly, is that for women, it's not just testosterone. There's an estrogen component as well that's really important in terms of your desire, your ability to self-lubricate. And at the same time, all the other hormones matter as well, along with stress hormones. And this stress hormone picture that I'm talking about and thyroid and insulin, this applies to all bodies, okay? Doesn't matter if it's ovaries or testes, all bodies are affected by these hormones and it can affect their desire. Now, when we look at the research and we look at, okay, psychologically, like, are there these differences going on? What we understand is that there are more women who will identify with what's called responsive desire. And that's where I talk about, like, you got to get things going to like get things going. Like, it's like you're not in the mood for sex until you've actually started foreplay. That is normal. It's called responsive desire, and both men and women can experience that. And then what we have is spontaneous desire, which is what the media shows us that all men should be like, which is, you know, they just always want sex. Sex is always on the brain. They always are chasing tails, so to speak. And in reality, that spontaneous desire, that isn't something that every man experiences, and women do experience it. But when women experience it, they're often told things like, oh, you have the sex drive of a teenage boy. Like, you are more like a man. And really, when you stand back, this is just a misframing and misunderstanding that men are supposed to be one way and women are supposed to be another way. And it's just absolutely not true. And I talk about in the book, the clitoral conspiracy. So, you know, everybody's heard like the clitoris was discovered in the 1990s. Lies. No, it wasn't. It was discovered a very long time ago. And it was actually in French, the translation is shameful member. So what does that tell you right there? It was something to be shameful of. And they cut it out of anatomy textbooks. Even to this day, the majority of medical anatomy, this means the books your doctor is learning from, do not have medically accurate illustrations of the clitoris, which is why in Is This Normal? You will find three. I put three in there and I'm like, if nothing else, y'all are going to know more than what your doctor knows about the clitoris. So I've talked about, we've got the component of the different ways that sexual desire can work. the responsive and the spontaneous sexual desire, the idea that women have to be different and that if it's a problem, it's got to be testosterone, and that we don't know about the clitoris, right? A lot of people don't. My necklace, you can't see it behind the mic. It actually says clitorit, which is a term that Ian Kern coined to just talk about like being actually literate about the clitoris. And then we've got a whole other component. It's called the dual control model, which is all about things that turn us on, things that turn us off. And this was research done by Bancroft and Jansen to first understand men. And so if everybody's listening, they're like, well, she's in women's health. Why is she talking about men? Because I think it's so important that we understand that these experiences are universal and that there is a lot of similarity. Although I did tell you with hormones, it can be different with women. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. So the similarity being that our nervous system has to be ready and tuned to accept the sexual inputs. And those are the accelerators. And if we have too many brake pedals on, those are things like stressing about our body image, stressing about unintended pregnancy, stressing about our relationship, like a lot of stress is what you're hearing. That is going to basically create a nervous system chaos in which you cannot receive the signals that maybe your partner is trying to throw your way. And in those instances, it's also another time to feel like, why am I out of the mood? Now, when I talk about stress and I talk about women, I want people to understand that the female body is more attuned to the stressors of the environment because, biologically speaking, whether or not you want a baby, whether or not you can have a baby, biologically speaking, the tissues, the cells, everything about your being is set up to survey whether it's safe or not to have a baby. And so if it's not safe, you've got to like, let's just face it. Babies are noisy. All right. They're going to give away. You're like hiding from a predator. They're going to give you away. It's like my biggest fear. Like what if there was a zombie apocalypse and I have a baby or I'm pregnant? How am I going to outrun the zombie? Like, I don't know how I'm going to do that. Like that's like way out there. But if it's a different kind of predator, like the real kind, like a tiger. Okay. How are you going to do that? The body knows. The body is inherently wise. So your doctor said, eat right and exercise. You just need to eat less, move more. And you're doing that. And now you're like, I'm never in the mood. That's because that's a negative input on the system. You just told your body the environment's not safe. It doesn't have enough food. And so we have to understand that these different types of stressors will cause biological shifts in our hormones that can impact our sexual desire. Why impacting our sexual desire, our ability to get in the mood? Because the safest way to live your life in moments that are high stress is to protect you from not becoming pregnant, which means you have no interest in having sex. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, it definitely makes sense. So does this relate in like functional medicine? They talk about the pregnenolone steal, cortisol steal, where the body's prioritizing cortisol production at the expense of DHEA and the sex hormones. So is that kind of what you're talking about?
I'm so glad that you brought that up. Yeah. So pregnenolone steal is an outdated way to think about it. And so I just want to bring that you're like not, I'm not like shaming you or scolding you for saying that, because if you ever learned about it back when we learned about it, that's how we talked about it, was the pregnenolone steal, was this idea that pregnenolone, the mama hormone, she's given birth to cortisol and progesterone. But in that moment, she's like, I got to birth more cortisol, forget the progesterone, and there's nothing left over. And now that we have more research understanding the mitochondria and how this is all working, what's actually happening is the master orchestrator of hormones, that is your pituitary, your hypothalamic pituitary axis of wherever it goes, right? Whether it's the adrenal axis, the ovarian axis, ovarian, adrenal, thyroid axis, that is orchestrating things to say, let's get cortisol up. Let's make sure we're dampening down progesterone. And in the book, I have a whole diagram of how stress affects you. Because I think too often as doctors, we say, you need to work on your stress. You like, and you know, in functional medicine, we don't do it like that. But the average woman or the average provider's visit that the woman is experiencing, she may go in and they're going to say, you just need to get a handle on your stress. Well, why? And what does that even mean? What does that do? Well, as stress goes up, we know cortisol production goes up. and ovarian function goes down. So it's not just progesterone, but it's the all of the cycle can be impacted. And in extreme stress, like hypothalamic amenorrhea, we see that you will lose your period. And that is, you are not getting enough calories, you are over-exercising. And anyone who has ever had a significant life stressor, like your dog dies, somebody close to you passes away, maybe you were in a car accident and you miss your period, that's actually normal. Your body was like, hold up, survival will always come before procreation, and your body is shifting in a way to protect you. And that's what I think functional medicine does a lot different, is we stand back and we ask why. Why would your body choose to take this path rather than trying to strong arm the body into submission and be like, body, you're misbehaving. I'm going to give you a medication, going to suppress that, going to do these things. And listen, sometimes we need medications. However, even in when we need a medication, we still need to ask why. Why did the dysfunction develop? And I say dysfunction as in, if you are not menstruating, you're not therefore not ovulating regularly, and you should be, something has become dysfunctional in the system. The adaptation, which is meant to keep you alive, is adapted too far. You've adapted too close to the sun, friends. You're burning up. Like, what is happening here? And so we have to ask the question, why did this happen? Why did this shift happen? And work at that level.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, just all this is really fascinating. Definitely want to talk about orgasms, because I don't think we've spoken. Well, I'm 100% sure I've not spoken about this on the.
Everyone wants to talk about orgasms.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So, and obviously there's going to be overlap too. I mean, there's going to be related in many people. Thyroid health is going to play a role, the stress hormones like cortisol, but there's also going to be some psychological aspects as well. So yeah, let's talk more about orgasms. Why? Oh, actually, one more thing before we get into orgasms, and if this is going to take long, we could skip over this, but every now and then there'll be someone who has a heightened libido. What would be the cause of like having too high of a libido?
There's no such thing as too high of a libido. That is your normal. When we say somebody's libido is too high, what we're really saying is that they have spontaneous desire. That's the mode that they're activated on and that they're going through life. And so that is completely normal. We get in trouble when we start pathologizing what is normal. And that is definitely one of those instances where people are like, your sex drive is just too high. And the other thing that happens sometimes in those situations is that that person's, their default of when they're stressed is actually to have desire. That's not as common to be in the mood when you're stressed. But I think those people's biology are really hip to the fact that the orgasm that we're going to talk about is going to release oxytocin, which combats cortisol's negative effect. So cortisol will not only aid you in what you can see, but cortisol will aid you at the cellular level. If you are exposed to chronic stress, we know the brain suffers significantly. You can have memory deficits, cognitive deficits. And so with that, orgasms can actually help and bring on the oxytocin. These people will also get, and this is what everybody gets, right? When they're intimate, is the connection. And that connection, that intimacy, that act of mindfulness, which if you want to have an orgasm, it is an act of mindfulness. You have to be present in your body to even arrive there. Those things we know help stress. If it was outside of sex, it would help stress. But so sometimes that's also where people are like, something's wrong with you because you want to have sex when you're stressed. And it's because something about their being knows that like, these are all the things I could check so many boxes with this that are going to be helping me drop my stress quickly and optimizing my hormones.
All right. So yeah, talking more about orgasms. A question I have with orgasms then, like, is it normal as you get older, like, you know, I'm in my 50s, but even like beyond that, like 60s, 70s, you know, you're going to have decreases, natural decreases in the hormones. Can someone in their 70s, 80s expect to have orgasms like they would in their 20s and 30s, or even again, people in their 50s, or should they expect a decline where maybe they could still get an orgasm as they get older, but you know, it's more challenging? Or is it just because of what we've been discussing as far as, well, the older people get and they're more likely to have some of these other health issues develop, and some people have them for years, like Hashimoto's could be undiagnosed for like 10, 15 years. And anyway, I'll stop rambling and I'll have you talk about orgasms.
When I tell you how rampant STIs are in nursing homes, that's all I gotta say, that no, you shouldn't just be losing your ability to orgasm because you are aging. Now, as you brought up the case of Hashimoto's, hypothyroidism, long-term undiagnosed, that's going to affect the cardiovascular system. Anything that negatively impacts the cardiovascular system or our blood glucose, our blood sugar, and our insulin levels, that can impact your ability to orgasm. Now, as we get older, we are at higher risk of developing diabetes and having circulatory issues. Now, when we look back at the research, and most of it has been done on men, shocker, I know, because if a man can't have an erection, it's like, stop everything. Like, we have to figure out what's going on. And I think that's a very good thing. We should also apply that to women. Now, the clitoris and the penis are the exact same embryological tissue. When you're an embryo, you get this hormone that it's called testosterone that comes through. And if you've got a Y chromosome with the right genes, then you have a penis, you have scrotum, you have testes. And if you don't, you have a labia, you have a clitoris. And I outline all of this in the book. The clitoris and the penis, same tissues, get erections. And erections require nitric oxide, which we know those pathways can slow as we age. They also require good blood flow and circulation, and something that we know that is affecting far too many people in the United States that can impact our clitoral health, our penile health, is diabetes. And so if you have somebody with erectile dysfunction, you need to look at their cardiovascular health. You need to look at diabetes. This is what I was taught in my nutrition science classes 20 years ago. The same is true for the clitoris. So if somebody starts complaining of inability to orgasm, simplest thing is that I, one, like to validate it that, like, yeah, it can sometimes be a struggle for a lot of different reasons. But getting older isn't a death sentence for your sex life. And in fact, many women who are postmenopausal report having much better sex 50 plus, 50 years plus, than their 20 something self. Part of it is, sure, you're more comfortable with your body. Others is, you know, it's experience and you understand your body more. But it's also the threat of an unintended pregnancy, which can mess with your nervous system, pull you out of the mood, is no longer there. And they're finding that they do orgasm better. They have a much better sex life. So I want people to understand that. Not a death sentence. And if you're starting to struggle, definitely get that investigated. Get it looked into, because something else might be going on. Now, the other piece that I want to say about, you know, sex as you age is lubrication is a must. If you are not having adequate lubrication, which is estrogen dips during certain times of your cycle or postmenopausal, then you're going to need more lubrication. And that is absolutely normal as well. And, you know, I said that was the last thing I was going to say. I'm going to say one more thing about orgasms. The research tells us that only about 18% of women report being able to orgasm by vaginal penetration alone. And that is based on their anatomy. Their ability to do that is based on their anatomy. Predetermined, nothing they can control. It's just the distance of where's the clitoris, where's the vagina. And so this is important for people to understand, because it may very well be you need more clitoral stimulation in order to reach an orgasm. And that is completely normal.
So like more foreplay, you're saying, or
as an example, at least. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I appreciate this, because I talk about in the book about foreplay. So using the word foreplay, like, we all know what that means. And I love common language so that we can arrive at the same place and start to understand that. We have to also recognize that foreplay is actually sex, and that it can be totally gratifying. You can achieve an orgasm. By the way, when you ask people, hey, remember your best sex of your life and tell us, like, what made it the best sex, they don't often report orgasm. I want people to understand that as well. Best sex of your life, people say things like intimacy, connection, vulnerability. They don't say orgasm, but we put so much emphasis on the orgasm. And as a hormone doctor, I do think having an orgasm is great. And if you can't, we should investigate things, but understand that, like, every sexual adventure, you're not going to hit an orgasm. And you may hit your orgasm in foreplay and decide not to have penetration if you're in a heterosexual relationship. Or you might hit it in foreplay, have penetration, and hit it again. It's totally up to you. But when we use the word foreplay, I never want people to feel the pressure And I want to just acknowledge the pressure that foreplay is to most people in their minds. This is the stuff that happens before. It's not the main event, but it can totally be the main event. And so when it comes to clitoral stimulation, that can happen on its own, or it can happen in conjunction with a partner and having vaginal penetration at the same time. But the clitoris, I list in my book, there's a lot of ways to reach an orgasm. There are people who it's like documented, like thinking off, like people can just think about it and they can have an orgasm. There are people that they go to the gym and they work out and they randomly have an orgasm. It's called a corgasm. They're working their abs and they're like, I did not intend for this to happen. So there are a lot of ways to arrive there. However, the majority of people are going to arrive there via the clitoris. And the clitoris, because it is not on the outside like the penis, and because it doesn't have to also pass urine and ejaculate, the penis has a lot of jobs to do. The clitoris has one, and that is provide pleasure. And because the clitoral structure, what you see on the outside, just the tip of the iceberg, the clitoral structure actually extends inside. And because of that, it can be more sensitive because it is more protected. It's not being stimulated all the time. And it in fact is. And those neuronal pathways are the primary way that people orgasm. In the book, I also talk about people who have spinal cord injuries and how they find new ways to orgasm. Because the body, this is how important pleasure is. And I think, you know, if somebody's like tuning out right now or their doctor's dismissing them, understand that the pleasure of being a human is so important that if you have a spinal cord injury, that pathway that went to the penis or to the clitoris, those nerves will set up other places. And now people are noticing that like, oh, I can be stimulated on this other area of my body and achieve an orgasm. And I want people to understand that that is because the brain is set up to be the big sex center and it sends out those nerves seeking out pleasure. And so your body thinks it's important. The World Health Organization thinks it's important. The research says it's important. This is not something we should take for granted.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. Yeah, definitely a lot more in the book. So yeah, I highly recommend, you know, everyone either reading it or listening to the audiobook version like I did. So I have two quick questions, but they might not be two quick answers. So if you don't have time,
I'm going to do it. Okay. I talk a lot. I get excited.
Just because nobody has spoken about the vaginal microbiome. So the first question is if you could just briefly talk a little bit about the vaginal microbiome and how to support it. And then just briefly talk about your 28-day plan, because I know people will have to read the book or again, listen to it, because there's no way you could talk about the whole 28-day plan in just like a couple of minutes. But can you touch upon those two things before we wrap it up?
Yeah, I just want to say I have ADHD. I write my books for brains with ADHD that you never have to read it front to back. You can jump in anywhere you want and you will still get what you need out of it. And same with the plan. If you want to just jump into the plan, you can just do that. And while you're going, go back and read it as you go. So you wanted me to talk about the 28-day plan, but before we get there, I want to get into the vaginal microbiome. So the vaginal microbiome, everybody needs to understand, it's not just the vaginal microbiome. There's a cervical microbiome. There's an endometrial microbiome. There's a tubal microbiome. There's ovarian microbiome. These microbes are everywhere. And I talk all about it in the book. The biggest thing I think that women need to understand is that your estrogen matters so greatly to the health of your entire microbiome, your skin, your gut. As you enter menopause, we see that microbial diversity drops as estrogen drops. Your estrogen is so important and your vaginal microbiome is no different. Estrogen stimulates the cells that produce the glycogen, that's the sugar that feeds the lactobacilli in the vagina. Lactobacilli are why you have a pH that keeps yeast in check, it keeps BV out and helps protect against other pathogens. So taking care of your estrogen, as I outline in the book, is absolutely essential to taking care of your vaginal microbiome. And I have an entire chapter about discharge and talking about BV, yeast infections, other types of infections as well, but what you can do naturally to be working on that every day to optimize your vaginal microbiome. I think we're going to find in the future as it relates to cancers, that there is a link to what's happening in the microbiome there, not just by way of hormones, but also the inflammatory processes that can occur. And that's probably going to be like when I'm well into menopause. So don't wait on the research, like just start taking care of your body now in the common sense ways that maybe your mama already taught you and that the new science is showing you that I talk about in the book. 28-day program, that is where we are going to get into how to optimize your hormones and how to understand your normal when it comes to sex throughout your cycle. And I designed the program so you can just do the hormone thing if you want, or you can also bring the sex stuff along too, so that you can understand your normal. Rather, I mean, the thing about libido and orgasms, like we don't go to our neighbors and we're not like, oh, what is your, like, let me compare my sleep to you and then judge and shame myself for it. Or like, are you talking to them about like their periods and then feeling shame and judgment? You are not. But when it comes to libido and orgasms, we often compare ourselves to others and then think something is wrong with us. And odds are there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. We need to help you discover your normal. And when you know that normal, you can get the pleasure that you want and also enjoy the hormone benefits that come along with it.
All right. Well, thank you. Thanks for, again, discussing briefly the vaginal microbiome, the 28-day plan. Definitely, again, I was listening to it. And I think, yeah, do you have two chapters, I think, dedicated to the 28-day plan? Like it was quite a while. Like, again, it was in great detail. It's not like just spending like 5-10 minutes on it.
I love, there's been people that are like, yeah, I got the audiobook and I like needed the real book to see the checklist, to see the charts, like to go through the plan. It's a very interesting book because so many people have said they're listening to the audio and they've got the physical book and they're looking at it as well. I'm like, that's so interesting to me. That's how I usually do things. But with the 28-day plan, there's a chapter setting it up so that you understand the why, the how, what to be tracking, all of that. And then there's the plan of like, let's just get in and let's do it. And I separate it that way because I think it can just become way too much information when it's like, you're doing the plan and I'm explaining to you all the reasons why you're doing the plan. And here's the next step of the plan. And I'm explaining all that. I'm like, I'll explain it. But some people are like, I don't even want the explanation. Like, I'm just gonna do this thing.
All right. Well, where could people get the book? I mean, should they go to your website? Should they go to Amazon like I did, or anything else you'd like to share? Social media, the resources?
Yeah. Well, if you go to drbrighton.com, drbrighton.com/ITN-resources, that's Is This Normal? Resources. There is a 4-week meal plan, recipe guide for you to help you optimize your hormones. And we've got other bonuses and goodies there. It goes along with the book really well. So you can grab it now, pick up the book later, and you can get the book anywhere that books are sold, really. Of course, most people use Amazon. You can request it at your local bookstore, call your library about it. And then drbrighton.com also has the book. But we rarely ever can outcompete Amazon. Just be honest there.
Okay. And then you're on social media. So I'll make sure I include the links to Instagram. You're on TikTok as well?
Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, Threads. Yeah. At Dr. Jolene Brighton.
All right. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Jolene. Again, it was awesome listening to your book and it was awesome chatting with you about your book. And I'm sure, you know, the listeners learned a lot. And yeah, I definitely did as well.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was so great to see you again.
Yeah, same here. You take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Save My Thyroid podcast. If you haven't done so already, make sure you hit subscribe to stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics. And to get your free thyroid and immune health restoration action points checklist, visit SaveMyThyroidChecklist.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.
So I really enjoyed listening to Dr. Jolene's book. Such a great book. Is This Normal? And this was such a great interview. And so starting out by talking about everyone's normal is different and common versus normal. So she gave period pain as an example of being common but not normal. Again, some mild cramping, that's normal as well as common. But again, if you're actually experiencing period pain, that's not normal. That was nice that she brought that up. And then endometriosis. So she mentioned commonly missed for years, like up until, I forgot if she mentioned if it's an average of 11 years until diagnosis. I mean, because that's a long time if like that's the average. But yeah, just, I mean, a lot of things are misdiagnosed. And I could see that. I could see and endometriosis can definitely be complex. And she gave some good information. Might be a good idea maybe in the future just to have like an entire episode on endometriosis as well. And I will say that one thing I learned with the dried urine test, Dutch test, a common pattern with endometriosis is having a high 16-OH estrogen, the estrogen metabolites, the 16-OH estrogen being high. Doesn't mean that someone has endometriosis, but if someone's suspecting that they might have endometriosis due to certain symptoms, then they do the Dutch test and the 16-hydroxy estrogen metabolite is elevated. Again, it's not going to confirm or diagnose endometriosis. It's just something to keep in mind, something I learned by actually Precision Analytical Labs, which is the lab that produces the Dutch test that developed it. You know, they have their own tutorials, so they want practitioners to understand the test just because if we understand it, we're more likely to recommend it. So I remember one of the presentations focused on that. Dr. Jolene also spoke about the importance of T2. So we hear about T3 and T4 when it comes to thyroid hormones, not a lot about T2. There are now some T2 supplements out there, but she mentioned that optimal thyroid hormone important for follicular development and that T2 itself is involved in follicular development and plays a role in the quality of the eggs, the health of the ovaries, but then also mentions that T4 is also important in follicular development and preventing miscarriage. So again, it's not just about T2. Obviously, you need healthy levels of T4 as well as healthy levels of T3. So yeah, just very interesting. And then so I asked her about low libido, but then also heightened libido, just because every now and then I'll have someone on the health history put down that they have a heightened libido. So as far as low libido causes, she mentioned a number of factors like thyroid hormone imbalances, insulin resistance, stress itself, which could affect adrenals. But she also mentioned that there's no such thing as having too high of a libido, that this is related more to spontaneous desire. So that was interesting. Yeah. So I, again, never asked anybody that question. And, you know, she's an expert. So that, like I said, that's interesting. I know hyperthyroidism causes a lot of unusual symptoms. So not to say most of the people I work with a hyperthyroidism have a heightened libido, because that's not the case. But again, I haven't seen anything in the literature about hyperthyroidism causing heightened libido. But if someone has always had a heightened libido, then yeah, I would agree with her. It's maybe just, you know, they're normal, but if it's something that developed when someone developed hyperthyroidism, maybe it is related to the thyroid hormone being elevated. And then so orgasms and corgasms. So I never heard of corgasms. So I'll talk about corgasms in a minute. But as far as not having orgasms, as she said, most people are not going to have an orgasm every single time. But certain factors, again, having imbalances in the thyroid hormone, dealing with a lot of stress. She really put an emphasis on blood sugar imbalances like type 2 diabetes as well. That definitely could be a factor, and that relates to like cardiovascular health, blood flow. But then she also mentioned psychological issues. Like, for example, as we get older, once a woman's in postmenopause, there's not that threat of an unintended pregnancy. So, you know, where that psychological factor could definitely, you know, affect a woman and maybe even a man having, you know, an orgasm as well. So just interesting. And then, so she mentioned a corgasm, which I have never heard about until she mentioned that you get while working out. I did some quick searching. I saw there's actually a book called The Corgasm Workout. Reviews weren't too good, like 3.9 on Amazon, but yeah, I probably won't be reading that book or listen. I don't know if there was an audio version of that book, but even if there is, I probably won't listen to that book, but just interesting. So I usually learn something during every podcast interview, but did not expect to learn about corgasms. And then vaginal microbiome. So she mentioned having healthy estrogen is important for the entire microbiome, not just the vaginal microbiome, as the estrogen stimulates the cells that produce the glycogen that feed the lactobacillus in the vagina, which helps to keep the pH in check. And they use some of that marketing when it comes to vaginal probiotics, which I meant to ask her, but we were just kind of running out of time and didn't chat after the interview. But I guess the thing with the vaginal probiotics, they very well might help, but even if you take them, you want to do things to like help with having healthy estrogen. I mean, that's the underlying cause. So if someone could avoid taking the vaginal probiotics long-term, you know, and just have healthy estrogen, you know, that would be great. But yeah, so again, just that was very interesting. And I also should mention, when I interviewed her, I mentioned that nobody else had spoken about the vaginal microbiome. And I actually interviewed Dr. Amatma Simmons on fertility. And I forgot that we actually had a little bit of a conversation. Like she mentioned testing of the vaginal microbiome. And her interview was before, but she's having a summit on fertility. So she wanted me to hold off on releasing it. I think I'm not 100% sure as of recording this, but I think Dr. Jolene's interview might come out before Dr. Amatma's. But if it comes out after and you hear me say this is the first time or talk about the vaginal gut microbiome, or I'm sorry, the vaginal microbiome, again, that wasn't completely true. But yeah, like I said, I forgot that I did speak about that with Dr. Amatma. But again, she didn't mention anything about the estrogen, Dr. Amatma. She just spoke about testing for the vaginal microbiome. All right. Well, again, really very comprehensive interview and just really enjoyed chatting about low libido. Again, I'm like 99% sure this is the first time that we had a chat on the podcast about orgasms. 100% sure it was the first time that, you know, someone mentioned, or at least I heard corgasms, you know, mentioned. Maybe someone else mentioned and just went through one ear and out the other. But yeah, hopefully you found this interview to be valuable. And as usual, I look forward to catching you in the next episode.
I want to let you know about a product called Hepatoimmune Supreme, which is a unique supplement that has a rare combination of N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, milk thistle, and schisandra to support the liver. And it also has a few mushrooms that can help support the immune system, including cordyceps, which has both immune modulating and adaptogenic properties and is great for those with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's. To learn more about Hepatoimmune Supreme, visit SaveMyThyroid.com/liver support.